Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and today we've got a great one. I mean, one of the films I've been very much looking forward to this summer was The Dark Knight. And I gotta say, if you get a chance to check it out in its IMAX form, I think you're really going to be blown away by it. It's a fantastic film, and one, honestly, that I like from the standpoint of the visual effects being incredibly seamless and really simply there to tell the story and really help support the story. And I also got to say that I was looking forward to this podcast this week. It's with Paul Franklin of Double Negative. And it was a couple years ago when we started these podcasts. We timed it to kind of coincide for when iTunes came out with the automatic downloading and so forth. And I had just quit my job. I was spending the summer in Colorado and kind of setting up all the infrastructure there remotely. And I remember kind of like, I think it was the fourth or fifth podcast, we had a fantastic two-parter with Paul Franklin talking about Batman Begins. It was at that point that I really thought, hey, I think we're onto something here with this little podcast thing we're doing, because it was really fantastic. I enjoyed the two-part series, and Paul is just a fantastic guest. So it's great to have him back again this time. He's the VFX supervisor from Double Negative, who's the primary facility on the movie. And I actually spent a lot of time here in Chicago, and I really enjoy kind of seeing the feature film stuff that's being done in Chicago, seeing it on the big screen, because it really comes off fantastic as Gotham. Well, why don't we go ahead now and join the conversation. Mike Seymour spoke recently with Paul Franklin of Double Negative.
Thanks for that. And Paul, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me back on the show again.
So we spoke in 2005 when you'd done Batman Returns, and that was Batman Begins, and that was a great film and was very successful for you. But I believe the shot count this time around is almost double that.
Well, I think the shot count for Double Negative was we did about 370 shots on this show. I think we worked on over 400 shots, but there were 370 finals. So it's about 100 shots more than we delivered on Batman Begins. But the big difference is that well over half of our shots for The Dark Knight were done in the full IMAX format. So actually, in terms of the amount of work involved, it equates to several times more work than we did for Batman Begins.
So I'm gonna get this out of the way at the beginning, because we've spoken before, and you know that well enough to know that I mean this sincerely when I say I think this film's a masterpiece. I think this is our generation's Godfather Part Two. I think you guys have done an outstanding job in a genre that's otherwise got quite predictable. This film is just magnificent.
It's certainly getting a very, very strong response. It's very kind of you to say that.
I mean, I think that it's strong in many levels. Obviously, the story is original, and it doesn't fall into the comic book cliches. Also, of course, magnificent performances by people like Heath Ledger. But your visual effects work is really seamless. It's some of the finest work I think you've done. You must be very proud of it.
We are indeed. It's that's extremely kind of you to say that. But it's I do feel it is in terms of seamless work. It's the standards that the guys achieve really just blew me away. I think everything exceeded expectation by some considerable distance.
Now, I should say I've seen it in IMAX, so I've seen it presented in that format, which, for those people that don't know, maybe you could just explain how the two different formats are going out for audiences.
Well, the film was shot on a variety. Well, some scenes were shot in the full IMAX format, which is 65mm, 15 Perth. So the frames are, I can't quite remember exactly what the aspect ratio is, but the aspect ratio is similar to that of a standard 4:3 television. And the rest of the film was shot in CinemaScope in 1:240. So when you watch the movie, you're watching the bits which are shot in scope. If you see it in an IMAX cinema, you'll see the scope picture letterboxed into the middle of the full-size IMAX screen. But then when we go into the IMAX sequences, the aspect ratio actually changes, which I think was really quite a radical decision to make very early on in the show. And the IMAX stuff just opens out to full frame and fills the full height of the frame. So you get these incredible establishing shots and an amazing depth of detail that's just not there in the scope material, which looks pretty good in its own right. If you see the film in a standard 35mm cinema, where I think the majority of people will actually see the picture, you will just see the scope picture. So it'll be a 1 to 240 screen aspect ratio. And for the IMAX sequences, what we did is we took a 240 extraction, normally out of the middle of the IMAX frame, but we actually move that extraction around to follow the action where necessary.
I mean, I think the thing that was concerned to me was that idea of it popping between, 2.4 and IMAX. And I was thinking, well, that's going to be quite jarring, and I'm quite interested to see it, but, you know, technically, a bit of a dangerous decision. And in fact, the people that I went and saw it with, no one really noticed that. I mean, I was looking for it, but it just seems to seamlessly move between the two. And it would certainly not be a reason to put anybody off. And if you've got a chance to see it in IMAX, I just can't recommend it enough, because it's just a glorious experience in a giant screen.
Well, you know something, you've got an advantage over me there, because I haven't actually seen the finished movie yet. It's cast and crew is later this week, so I've seen a large chunk of it, obviously, but not the whole thing.
Well, I won't give the plot away for you, Paul, but it
well, I have read the script.
Quite a good yarn. So let's discuss the IMAX stuff, because it is remarkable. There's a couple of things I think that from a technical level would be interesting to discuss. And I guess one of those things that when you articulate it, of course, it's immediately obvious. But I hadn't thought about how shallow a depth of field you're going to get. So obviously, when you're on 16mm or if you're on an HD, for example, an HD sensor, a small little target area, you tend to get a lot of depth of field. And as you move to 35, you get shallower depth of field. But on the IMAX, you're actually getting, like, I think someone had described it in American Cinematographer as a wide-angle lens with the depth of field of a zoom. Was that an issue for you guys?
It was actually. It was something I attended IMAX dailies in Chicago whilst we were out there shooting. Every night after we'd finished shooting, we'd go over to the IMAX theater there on Navy Pier in Chicago at about 4 a.m., 5 a.m. to actually do IMAX dailies. And you could just see we were watching the stuff that had been shot for the bank heist, the prologue sequence that we worked on. And the depth of field, even shooting in broad daylight, the depth of field is non-existent. If a guy's ear is in focus, so you've got a profile shot, then his nose will be completely out of focus. And it was a very definite look you were getting from this stuff. So we realized early on that depth of field tools and being able to recreate all the softening and all the bokeh shapes, all of these little interesting shapes you get caused by the aperture in the camera interacting with the defocus in the lens, was a very important thing to be able to mimic. And not only do we have to do that for the IMAX stuff, but of course the scope material also has very, very shallow depth of field. Chris and Wally like to shoot with long lenses a lot of the time, so they're shooting wide open, so the depth of field again is non-existent. And then of course the scope stuff has very interesting distinctive bokeh shapes. You get these long elongated shapes, and they in turn are also affected by how the barn doors are set on the camera, all sorts of other things that are inside the camera. The blades on the iris of the camera. So at the very beginning, we decided to write a new set of tools for Shake that would allow us to mimic these depth of field effects that you see in the film. So we could seamlessly match and customize every shot, depth of field and all the blur shapes.
The other thing that's interesting about the IMAX is because of the nature of the projection and the relationship to the audience to the screen, normally the theory is to lower the sort of midpoint of where you'd be focusing at, so somebody who would normally be focused with only a small amount of headroom actually ends up with a huge amount of headroom in a normal IMAX film.
Yes, that's true. I think the standard rule is to frame for the lower third of the frame, because most people, that's basically where you're looking, and effectively everything above it is sky. That is definitely the way that they framed a lot of the stuff for some of the sequences. I think some of the more dialogue-based moments that you have in the IMAX sequences. But by and large, they just treated the IMAX as if it was a very, very large 35mm camera, standard 35mm camera. So there wasn't too much concession made for that sort of thing, really. Though we always tried to keep the action within the 240 extraction area so that it would also work for the scope version of the film later on.
But the filmmakers did point out that they really needed to. I mean, I think it's seven times the data just in terms of the scans. You were doing very high risk scans, and that means that everyone had to be meticulous in their work, from literally on set to makeup to visual effects. So, tell me about the scanning. What resolution was the IMAX scanned at, and how was that done?
I think the IMAX was scanned at it was about 8.1K. I'm actually just going to bring up the I've got the actual figures here somewhere. The tells you what the resolution was, but it was there were 8K scans. We typically down-res them to 5.6K, which we did a lot of testing at the beginning of the whole project to work out, you know, what would actually work for you know, work best. We had built a pipeline that would have allowed us to work at full 8K throughout the whole show, which, oh, here we go. It's 8,192 by 5,975. That's what the scans came in at. And then we down-resed it to, we subsampled it down to 5,616 by 4,096. And so it's quite funny. We would consider 2K, standard 2K, we consider to be a low-resolution proxy of what we were actually working on. And but to be honest, the 8K was really only necessary for very high contrast, daylit shots where the camera would linger for a long time on lots and lots of detail. And you know, most of the work we're doing in The Dark Knight is action-based. There's lots of motion blur, lots of camera movement. A lot of it's at night in low lighting levels. And really the difference between 8K and 5.6 at that point was really non-existent. Though we did complete all the shots for the bank heist sequence, the prologue, which went out in front of Iron Legends IMAX release. That was all done at 8K in order to test out the whole thing, test it to destruction, the whole pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting aspects about the on-set work, and obviously you were on set. So let's, just before we get into some of the details of the post stuff, just give people some parameters, because it is so unusual to be doing this. It's the first time, certainly that I'm aware of, that a major feature film's done this. And shot with the IMAX. I mean, not least of which is the load. Like, if I'm not mistaken from my research, on set they would have a load, a 500-foot load, that would last 100 seconds in the camera at 24 frames a second. I mean, and yet you say they were treating it like a normal 35 camera, but I mean, there are some really big issues with a horizontally loading IMAX large format camera.
This is true. I mean, the IMAX format produces amazing results, but it is quite temperamental. You know, all the cameras are custom built pieces of equipment. I think there were only 10 IMAX cameras available in the world that were actually up to shooting the material on this film. And in fact, the guys managed to trash one whilst we were doing it. So there are now only 9 IMAX cameras that can do this work.
And the lenses were unusual as well, right? They weren't. I mean, obviously.
Well, the lenses for the IMAX cameras are essentially the same kind of lenses that you get on a large format Hasselblad stills camera. They're the Zeiss lenses, and then I think they're made in exactly the same factory. So they're stills lenses, so they're not quite modern spherical lenses. So when you pull focus on the things, you know, the image breathes quite heavily. So it's in terms of setting up lens grids and doing all that sort of stuff in order to characterize the lenses, it's very similar for process to what you would have to do for a standard anamorphic shoot.
Because this is the thing leading into pose, isn't it? That there are a lot of unusual aspects to the camera that you had to mimic very, very closely, because you're intercutting between live action and visual effects, in addition to obviously compositing into them.
Yes. Well, something we'd done for Batman Begins was that we went to great lengths to characterize all the idiosyncrasies of the lens, I suppose, if you will. So we worked out a process that allowed us to shoot very, very detailed lens grids to be able to map the distortion on the anamorphic lenses. Because for Batman Begins, they were all vintage anamorphic lenses from the 50s, as they were the anamorphic lens set on this film, on Dark Knight, was again a vintage 50s anamorphic set. So you know, they're full of all sorts of weird distortions and idiosyncrasies. The IMAX lenses are less prone to that sort of thing. They are modern stills lenses, so the kind of unique warp patterns that you see with the scope lenses weren't there. But what we did do is we went to the lengths of digitally sampling the flare patterns again. This is something we developed for Batman Begins, where we had a custom fabricated mount made for our digital SLRs that allowed us to mount the anamorphic lenses onto our digital SLRs and then digitally photograph the flare patterns we were getting. And we did the same thing with the IMAX lenses. The advantage this time was that there's already a camera which will mount the equivalent lenses, which is, of course, the large format Hasselblad. So we rented a digital Hasselblad back and got hold of an equivalent lens set, which is near as damn it the same as the ones that we were shooting on. But it was quite a lengthy process to go through all that. But perhaps the the biggest thing we did was the whole depth of field thing that we talked about earlier on.
So I'm going to discuss the building stuff in a moment, because that was something we discussed a lot back in 2005, and obviously of great interest. But while we're still on this issue of the camera, I think it's good to talk about the bike chase sequence, or the Batpod, mainly because, as you said, they were treating it pretty much like a 35mm camera. So there were times that they were shooting IMAX, basically with a giant arm off the back of a custom Mercedes SUV, and this produced... just extraordinary material, but it was this material that you did a lot of work with, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. The whole bike chase, or the armored chase, as we call it, because it's all about chasing after the armored car, which starts with the armored car in convoy with the SWAT guys, and then the Joker turns up in his big trucks and causes havoc. Batman appears in the Batmobile, manages to save the armored car from being destroyed, but in so doing so, the Batmobile is trashed. And then the Batpod comes out of the wreck of the Batmobile and then chases after the Joker. And then there's finally this climactic scene at surface level where there's this most amazing piece of special effects work. We flip the truck 180 degrees over and slam it down on the road. As you say, that was primarily shot with the lev head on an Ultimate arm mounted on a Mercedes ML SUV and running one of the big MSM cameras, the big MSM IMAX cameras. This is the sequence during which we trashed one of the cameras, that it got slammed between two stunt vehicles. It was a complete write-off. The camera was totally destroyed, along with the lev head as well. But the material, the wealth of detail in that material was just extraordinary. And as was the case on Batman Begins, Chris Nolan would add shots to the sequence as we went along through editing, through cutting the sequence. And there were quite a lot of very complex, fully CG shots which were ordered up quite close to delivery, particularly the sequence in which the Batpod emerges from the Batmobile.
Now, let's discuss that, because, I mean, initially there was obviously an actual wrecked vehicle to shoot, but that ended up having to be completely replaced, and almost to a higher level of detail, wasn't it, by your guys?
Basically what you have, this moment where the Batmobile is struck by a rocket-propelled grenade launched by the Joker. And they did it as a practical stunt on Lower Wacker Drive in Chicago. They launched the Batmobile through the air off a moving ramp, set off a huge pyro charge in the back of it, and that's when you see it being struck in midair. Then you see it crash through all the bridge support pillars and the underground freeway. This was another full-size practical stunt effect, special effects done in the UK at this point. And then finally the car crashes to a halt, settles down in a big cloud of dust, and the Batmobile had been pretty much trashed and was covered in mud, and the panels were all cracked and everything. And originally the intention was to use the live action plates of the wrecked Batmobile and then enhance that and add our CG onto it. But as we developed the sequence, it became clear that we just didn't really have the angles, the coverage on the Batmobile, to be able to realize where the sequence was now going. We had opened out the sequence to a more elaborate series of stages where we affect the transformation of the Batmobile into the Batpod. And so really there was nothing for it but to replace it with a fully digital Batmobile.
Now, Paul, can I just interrupt you there? Because the sequence leading up to this crash also involved the shooting of miniatures, right? I mean, there was like a truck, not the truck that we see in the trailer that flips, the iconic image that now is burnt in, having seen that on IMAX. But no, the earlier, there are some other trucks underground that I'm referring to now. That was actually miniatures, right?
Yeah, that was a third scale miniature built and shot over at New Deal Studios. Ian Hunter was the miniature supervisor, visual effects supervisor for that sequence.
So you were intercutting your work with both miniatures and First Unit?
Yes, indeed. And the guys, the New Deal guys, as ever, did a fantastic job with the miniature garbage truck and their miniature version of Lower Wacker. And as I say, it's third scale. So they built, it was about 150 feet long, I think, the miniature of Lower Wacker that they built.
And they are very good. Very, very good. Yeah.
They're fantastic. We've worked with them several times on films like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Chronicles of Riddick. And in fact, Pitch Black, our very first show at Double Negative, the miniatures, a lot of the miniatures were done at what was then Hunter Gratzner Industries. But the miniature garbage truck, that was all constructed by New Deal. And then the Batmobile that hits it, I think, was a refurbished Batmobile from Batman Begins. It was a third scale miniature which had been built by Robbie Scott's team over at Cutting Edge. And there was quite a bit of enhancement work had to be done to that. Obviously, there was a lot of rig removal. The Batmobile is moving on a skate, which we had to remove from the miniature floor. We added a lot of dust enhancements. We also extended the back of the set and graded it extensively to match the live action that had been shot on Lower Wacker. And we added things like, you can actually, if you watch the shot where the Batmobile rams into the garbage truck, you can actually see the Joker's semi streaking past on the other lane, which was something we just lifted out of one of the plates of the full-size semi in action. It's just a little bit of extra detail we put in there, but it's tremendous.
One of the reasons I want to flag that is that where you used your new fluid dynamic stuff? Because you had some new fluid dynamic smoke effects or something, didn't you, that you'd built for this?
Yes, we did use it. We didn't use it on that shot specifically. I think we relied just on straightforward Meyer fluid dynamics. It was still rendered through our own proprietary DNV volumetric renderer. But then we used the fluid system, which is DN Squirt, to give it its illustrious title.
Yes.
Squirt was used to create all the tire smoke that comes off the Batmobile as the Batmobile begins to rev its front wheels up to speed in anticipation of the Batpod being launched. So a lot of the smoke and dust effects created in that sequence were done with Squirt.
And I interrupted you when you were just discussing the following sequence, obviously, when that crash inevitably leads to the pod or the bike coming off. And there, sure, again, you used your DN Dynamite, which we heard about, I think, earlier when we were talking. That's been developed now over a couple of years, hasn't it?
Yes, I think the first really major use of dynamite was on Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, where we used it to destroy the Hall of Prophecy, the big room storehouse all made out of glass that featured in that film. And we used it, we pressed it into service on several times on The Dark Knight. It was used extensively through the moment when the Batmobile finally releases the Batpod, and basically all the exterior panels of the Batmobile blow off like explosive panels, and then the Batpod leaps out through this expanding cloud of debris. That's all driven with the dynamite system.
What I really liked about all that stuff is that you resisted the temptation to have bits of stuff flying at camera and doing kind of CG gags. And so this triangle of live action first unit, the models, miniatures, and then, of course, your digital replacements all felt so incredibly grounded in real-world cinematography that I just bought the whole lot, holus bolus. It was really well integrated.
Well, I mean, to be perfectly fair, that a lot of that comes directly from Chris Nolan himself. He critiques these shots on a very, very detailed level, and Chris was very, very attuned to anything that he felt was forced or fake. So, flying debris into the camera, that sort of thing. If you ever see anything like that in the film, that's because it actually happened in camera. It might happen to be a real element that just happened to fly something into the camera. We had a moment like that in Batman Begins, during the monastery sequence, where a piece of debris flies straight into camera, and everyone said, "Oh, that's got to be fake." I said, "No, that's all in camera." In fact, because it was in camera, we weren't allowed to take it out, because it was just something that happened for real. So if something really happens for real, then we keep it.
But I think you're being slightly modest here, because while we applaud his vision of wanting to keep it real, sequences such as that chase that we've just been describing, I think, if I'm right in saying this, at some point was you're going to have a lesser role for you, and it was going to be more a matter of doing some digital projection and some stuff going through frame, and it actually turned into a much larger digital sequence. So clearly he was believing you were delivering to be able to extend those shots in the ways that he did.
Yeah, I guess the way that Chris works is that I think he will try to get it for real, and they did do a lot of special effects, practical work with the Batmobile, the wrecked Batmobile, the panels. We even had a rig where the panels all blew off the Batmobile, powered by nitrogen cannons, but it never really kind of had the force and dynamism that Chris wanted, or the energy that he wanted. It was the term that he used a lot. So I think what happens in any shot, any sequence that Chris is working on, there comes a point at which he says, right, now I need to go to visual effects, and he will then commit wholeheartedly to the visual effects process at that point. There is this sort of perception that Chris is very, very anti-visual effects. He's not anti-visual effects. He uses it very sparingly. He uses it where he feels is entirely appropriate, and he'll only use it when he feels entirely convinced that it's necessary at that point. So at a certain stage, sometimes he reaches this stage when he's actually shooting it on set, and he'll make that decision on set, and he'll even say to you, you know, we'll need to do this digitally later on. and then other times he'll get to that during the editorial process. And what we did for the certainly for the underground sequence in the armored chase was a combination of those things. There were a couple of shots of the Batmobiles, the Bat-Hotspurs, which were always planned to be digital. But then there were a couple of other shots which they hadn't planned for. You know, originally it was all supposed to be done, I think, in one shot, the birth of the Batpod. And eventually we ended up with four shots. So there were three fully digital shots which were added to that sequence, which largely came out of the editorial process.
And we discussed last time we spoke, or when we spoke about Begins a couple of years ago, how for the suit you were doing a lot of BRDF stuff to get good readings. And I'm wondering, how did you approach the metalwork, both of the digital bike, the digital car, and were you using similar techniques of actually scanning real materials to get that fed into your pipeline, or?
Well, as far as the suit went, we were actually able to reuse the BRDF measurements from Batman Begins, because whilst the design of the suit has changed quite substantially between the two films, the actual finish on it is pretty much the same. It's still the same materials, which is black neoprene. There's some leather on the boots, and then the cape, which has this electrostatically bonded synthetic velvet on top of parachute material. So those, all the data we'd sampled last time was still applicable. What we then did is we rolled that into a new set of shaders, which are much more reliable and much more easy to control than the ones that we'd set up for Batman Begins. As far as the vehicles went, we actually relied more on a very, very detailed texture shoot. Again, the finishes on the bike and the car are kind of pretty standard metallic or matte black painted finishes. So there isn't really that much mileage in actually getting a BRDF setup for that thing. But in the meantime, since we did Batman Begins, we developed a much more sophisticated set of surface shaders for doing things like metallic objects. So our new DN surface RenderMan shader set is much more powerful than the ones we had available to us when we were doing the monorail train and the Batmobile last time. So it was a combination of the two things. We used the BRDF thing where appropriate, I guess, is the best way. The main application for it was in the cape, which is really the only part of the suit that approaches what you might call conventional cloth. And the cape is entirely reused from Batman Begins, because that was the only bit of the suit that didn't change its shape. It's the geometry for the cape was exactly the same as last time. Though we did, of course, have to do cloth simulation for the cape in a variety of different situations, mainly when the Batpod is blasting along on the road and you see the cape billowing behind it.
So let's swing back now to discussing, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of the city, because one of the fabulous things that you built up was an incredibly elaborate way of taking shots of Chicago and building them into and we discussed that, but I understand that due to the increase in, or the huge jump really, in resolution to IMAX, that it wasn't just a matter of being able to reuse the previous library this time round.
No, that's true. There were two different levels to the library. There's the photographic library that we built up in Chicago last time, which we shoot panoramic photographs bracketed across, I think in this case we were shooting across eight stops. And then we stitched these together with a proprietary tool set called STIG, which is similar to things like RealViz Stitcher, but it's resolution independent and it's very tightly wrapped around our 3D and 2D pipelines. And there have been numerous improvements to STIG, the best of which is that the actual stitching together of all the images is now automated, so it works. It's about 10 times faster than the version we had on Batman Begins in terms of the workflow. But the other thing was that whilst we had all these pictures from Chicago last time, they were largely taken under nighttime conditions, because a lot of Batman Begins was set at night, whereas The Dark Knight uses a lot of daylight material as well. And we decided that we wanted a building library that would work for both day and night. On Batman Begins, we had essentially baked in the lighting from the real-world locations. We'd photographed things at night under beauty lighting, reprojected them onto the geometry, and then baked them in, and bash, you've got baked-in lighting in the things. But we wanted buildings where we had much more control over it. So what we did this time around is we went back to a lot of the locations we'd shot last time in Begins, and we re-photographed them under flat-lit conditions. And the thing that made this possible was that digital SLR technology has moved along quite considerably. Whilst we were shooting on Canon D60s and 10Ds last time in Batman Begins, this time we were using the Canon 1DS Mark II, which is a much faster, much higher resolution digital SLR. And it's fast enough, and the resolution was high enough, that it meant that we could spend all day waiting for the light to be in exactly the right place on the building, and then the camera was fast enough to allow us to shoot out the whole facade at high resolution before the light had changed appreciably, which was just not possible when we were doing Begins. It would take us a couple of hours to shoot some of these panoramas on Batman Begins, so we would always try and go for the beauty lighting.
But also you had the room, you also had not just that facade, but the rooms, effectively a geometric projection inside the room behind the glass to give it that depth that just sold it as real. Can you talk about that?
That's our window box tool, which was originally developed for Begins. And it's, again, window box has been through several major upgrades. We comprehensively overhauled it a couple of years ago to do the work on World Trade Center to recreate the building surrounding Ground Zero. And, of course, a lot of World Trade Center takes place during the daytime, so it was necessary to make sure that we could get the kind of depth and detail that you see in daylit rooms from outside. So there were general just improvements and cleanups there. It can handle higher resolution than it did last time. But most importantly, we developed a high-level art direction tool set for it that basically allows the artists to get in there and direct the lighting in a much more interactive way in terms of which windows are lit, what the color temperatures are, what the content of the rooms are. It was quite a laborious process on Batman Begins, but this time it was far more intuitive. So we could generate lots of different looks from the same buildings just by changing the way that the windows were lit at night. So that was an important part of things.
Now, how did this all feed in, though? Because, if I'm right in understanding this, not only was the whole thing higher resolution, but you actually had sort of rooms or buildings closer to camera, in particular the end of the sequence we've been discussing earlier, the helicopter crashing and stuff. You were much, much closer to these buildings at vastly higher resolutions. It must have been a heck of a taxing thing on your render farm.
Well, there was this, early on we said, okay, well, we will do these shots as reprojection. We'll get plates on the location and we'll project them onto simple geometry. So we'll just rely on the on-set lighting to actually carry us through that and to get the detail. But, as is always the case, when you start working up the sequence and we were developing our animatics and layouts for the helicopter crash, we increasingly ended up in positions over the street that we just weren't ever going to be able to reach with a camera to be able to shoot the plate. And also they were very focused on shooting their principal photography down at street level. They didn't have a unit up there on the rooftops. So, they weren't ever going to give us the time to shoot those plates. So during post, we realized we're going to have to just get in there and do it fully CG. So all of the architecture that we built for Batman Begins had to be comprehensively upgraded. We essentially rebuilt to work at higher resolution, higher tolerances. And meanwhile, there was a whole other effort which had gone into upgrading the whole pipeline to do the 5.6K IMAX material and the 8K IMAX material. And this covered both the 2D pipeline and the 3D pipeline. And that proved to be so successful. The render times were so brilliantly optimized by our CG team, in particular Philippe Leprance, who's our CG supervisor in charge of the whole pipeline development for us on the 3D side of things. Philippe's new pipeline really just delivered incredible results, and so it became apparent to us quite early on that it was actually entirely possible to do the LaSalle Street scenes as entirely digital environments, just build them completely in 3D. The only limit we set on ourselves at that point is we said, okay, we'll only do this for the high level shots where we're high above the street looking down rather than stuff that's close to street level, because we felt that street level would always be too demanding to actually do. In the event, we started adding shots where, again, there just weren't plates available down at street level, and we ended up doing fully digital street level environments as well on a couple of shots. I think it was about five shots actually in total used street level digital environments, and again, it proved to be so successful that it all worked pretty much first time out of the box. So that's a good example of it completely exceeding expectations.
Now, when we spoke in 2005, we were discussing the fact you'd gone to an HDR pipeline, which was a first kind of for you back then. And one of the things we discussed was, I think, clip and slip, which were your playbacks. And we discussed at the time that you weren't quite getting 2K real-time playback. Now, clocks move forward and you can do real-time 2K playback. Of course, you don't want to playback 2K. You want to playback these vastly larger files. So how on earth did you actually review things other than the dailies you've already described at the IMAX?
Well, really, shooting out to film was only really the only viable option to actually see what the material would ultimately look like at full resolution, because there's no digital 5.6K playback system, which at least that I know of, that will actually display the whole frame in one go and allow you to see it in the correct resolution. What we developed is our 2D team, led by Andy Lockley, who's our compositing supervisor. He worked very closely with the R&D team to develop a set of tools that basically would allow us to tile up the images. So we, for quality checking, we could, when we'd finished a comp at 5.6K, we would then break it down into tiles, put it into the base light as a series of 2K tiles, and then we'd have to review all the tiles individually. But obviously that doesn't allow you to get a proper idea for what the composition of the shot actually is. So really this is just purely a technical check. What I likened it to was the way it used to be 10, 12 years ago when we had, when it was very, very difficult to play back 2K digitally and you still had to go out to film. So about 14 years ago, I worked on a movie called Hackers, and the only time we could ever see our film, our images at 2K was to shoot them to film and take them to the cinema. And, you know, the rest of the time, you just have to make an assumption of what it was going to look like. But that's what 3D artists have always done all the time I've ever worked in 3D since the early 90s, which is, you know, you do something and you make an assumption about how it's going to be transformed by the time it actually gets to the target resolution. And this is what we're doing at the moment for IMAX. So we'll have to see what the digital projection people and what have you come up with in the future to make our lives easier.
So it was, I presume, a process that was still traditional in the sense that you must have been at times working remotely. I think you used, did you use CineSync from RSS Research, Rising Sun?
Yes,
Research?
Yep. Yes, we did. Yeah, so CineSync was pretty much the backbone of dailies with both with Nick Davis, who was the overall VFX supervisor. Nick was spent quite a bit of time out in Los Angeles working with Chris when they were cutting the film, and also even when we were shooting the movie, and Nick was up at the Cardington studio, which is quite some distance north of London, and we're down in Soho in central London, and so we would use CineSync to have daily discussions. And then there were CineSync sessions, obviously, with Chris Nolan himself as well, and so you could, we'd get Chris's notes from those things too. And CineSync is an amazing tool. It's the interactivity is the key to it, really.
I mean, you were the lead facility on Dark Knight, but I guess we should point out that of the 370 shots you did, there's a couple of shots that would, to an outsider, appear to have been, you know, must have been done CG. But I think we should give sort of points to the special effects guys, because that large explosion of the hospital and the flipping of the truck that we've discussed really pretty much were in camera, weren't they?
Yes, that's entirely. The Chris Corbold special effects team, you know, they delivered an incredible result on Batman Begins a few years ago, and they really topped themselves on this one. The truck flip was just something awesome to behold. I mean, I think the truck flip idea had come out of various discussions, I think, both between Chris and the special effects team and also with the visual effects team as well. And Chris Corbold offered it up as a possibility to do it in camera for real. And so that was an amazing thing to see. We did some work on the shot, just cleaning it up, taking out the rigs, the nitrogen cannon that flips the truck over. And we actually replaced the road surface underneath the truck because there were quite a lot of shadows from the camera vehicles and things on the road, which we just couldn't get rid of in any kind of easy way in 2D. So we actually replaced the road underneath the truck.
Because they actually shot a huge bolt into the ground, right? And that was sort of facilitated the flip with the cannon. And then you painted that out?
Yeah, that's it. There's something like it's like a giant telegraph pole mounted in the trailer of the truck. The link between the cab and the trailer was rigid, so that this thing fires out down into the ground and flips the back end of the truck over. So the truck begins to go up in the air. On the front bumper of the truck are a set of teeth that dug down into the asphalt of the road, and that stops it from sliding forward. And then the thing just literally did this 180 flip end over end. And I was standing about 20 or 30 yards from it when it actually came down. We were in a little side alley off to the side, and we couldn't see the whole truck. We just saw the end of the truck slam down in front of us, and it was a truly surreal sight to see this thing destroying itself in front of you.
I have to say, on IMAX, I was literally having to arch my neck up to look way up to the top of the screen for the flip, because obviously it really took advantage of the vertical height that you got out of the IMAX format. And it was spectacular, but it was just a remarkable thing to conceive. And so, as I say, I think it's it's funny because you've done so much great work, but a lot of it is so seamless. And then you've got these big effects that anyone that wouldn't know would assume were done digitally, and obviously weren't.
Oh gosh, yes.
But it must have been good to work with those guys. You know, must have been good to integrate so well between the visual and special effects, because it's clearly
absolutely. I mean, what you get on the when you're actually on set. I mean, obviously the special effects guys are very, very busy getting these things set up, and really you're there as an observer, and we capture as much reference as we possibly can. And whilst obviously we weren't, other than just the rig removals and things, we weren't doing anything significant to that truck flip. You know, that's very definitely a special effects moment. What it then serves as, it serves a very good guide for, well, what are the other kind of things that you are doing digitally which need to feel like they fit with this whole kind of style of shooting. So that the helicopter crash that precedes that the truck flip, where the Joker's guys bring down the Jet Ranger in the street, that starts with a practical helicopter flying down the street and then finishes with a practical burning special effects rig tumbling along the street and crashing into the armored car. In between that, we have the digital moment where the chopper catches the wires, spins out of control, crashes into the building, and then finally slams down into the street and explodes. And those shots are entirely digital, with the exception of a couple of background plates that feature in two of the shots, but everything else is 100% CG. But and again, you know, that's a moment where you could have all sorts of crazy stuff flying into the camera, you know, go over the top with the pyrotechnics and what have you. And having that reality in the truck flip to look at, and you say, well, that's how that looked. You know, you've got to make your stuff feel as spectacular, but still grounded in the same way. And so it is a great thing to have.
Can you just, as a complete aside, maybe you can solve a bet for me, because I read, I'm sure, that there was actually someone driving that truck. Was that actually
there was, yes.
a stuntman
there
in
was
there?
Somebody in the truck. Yeah, there's a stuntman in the truck. I think partly this is because when Chris had surveyed the street, there's so many bank vaults and sewers and God knows what else underneath LaSalle that there was only a 50-foot stretch in which they could, a solid stretch of the road where they could do the flip. So, and also, you know, you had to ensure that the truck went straight down the line and flipped in the right way. So, yeah, there was one of the stunt drivers inside there. I mean, it was amazing that the city of Chicago would let you do something like that in the middle of their central financial district. I mean, they drew the line at crashing a helicopter into the building, but they let us blow one up on the street. So, again, you know, a lot of praise should go to the authorities in Chicago that just really allowed Chris and the crew incredible free reign to get what they needed to make the show. That's partly why we feature Chicago so heavily, and even in the visual effects shots, you've got recognizable Chicago landmarks this time, which we didn't have in Batman Begins.
I was going to say, this seems like a less stylized city. It's still Gotham, but the first one was architecturally based in Chicago, but had some very distinctively kind of stylized elements to it. This really does feel like it's a modern, reworked Chicago, as opposed to would that be a fair thing to say?
Oh, absolutely. Very early on, before we were awarded on the show, Nathan Crowley, the production designer, came around to see us. Nathan had designed Batman Begins. Nathan came to see us and explained to us that Chris's vision for the film was that this Batman Begins was essentially a stylized, cartoony movie now in their way of looking at it, and that The Dark Knight was going to be the realistic version of Batman Begins. And we thought, ooh, because we'd been set some pretty high standards to meet on Batman Begins. So this was going to be an interesting challenge. And straight away, Nathan started telling us about how he wanted to use real locations in Chicago, that they wanted to play a lot of the very cool modernist architecture. There's a lot of work shot in the buildings of the architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, who designed a lot of the significant landmarks in Chicago. And so we shoot quite a few interiors inside actual Mies van der Rohe buildings in Chicago. And that kind of all fed into this in this much more recognizable world. And so the stronger fantasy elements, like the monorail system, were very much backgrounded. A building like Wayne Tower, which featured in Batman Begins, the extraordinary Art Deco headquarters of the Wayne Enterprises empire, that's not there at all. We see a new Wayne Tower, which is a modernist skyscraper, and all we did is we actually shot a real building and we put the Wayne logo on it, and then we enhanced the city beyond it. So you see the city stretching off to the horizon. It kind of echoes a shot that we did in Batman Begins. And that is very much grounded in reality in that respect. And then the monorail system is there in the film, but it's very much in the background of only two shots. There's two big IMAX shots. I think the monorail system pops up in the background there. And that actually, the monorail system was the only asset that we used exactly as it was from Batman Begins. Everything else had some work done to it. But the monorail system, because it was playing very small in the background, is just there. hiding in the wings of the shot.
So let's round out the technical stuff now and just discuss how you do a film out, because you know, we're quite used to going to film out at 2K, but what was the process for getting out these IMAXs? Because obviously the IMAX version is going in a much higher resolution, whereas you obviously said before the film version was still going out as 2K. So for the deliverables, how did you handle that? Where were you sending the files, and how was that handled?
Well, the scans originally, the scans all came in for IMAX, as I say, at 8.1K, and then they were downsampled to 5.6 for working on a double negative. All of our 3D was rendered at 5.6K, and all the compositing was done at 5.6K, so we didn't comp at a lower resolution and then up-res to 5.6 later on. This was made possible by because of the new pipeline that we built. In particular, we built a 64-bit compositing pipeline that allowed us to work at these high resolutions in a reliable and efficient manner. And then we would deliver the files, the film outs. The 5.6K was converted to DPX files and then sent on hard drives via courier over to the United States. And it was all filmed out at Dave Keeley Productions in Los Angeles, who were the IMAX film out bureau for the film. We did do a little bit of test work with a chap called Simon Burley, who's actually a guy who used to work here at Double Negative, and he runs a film recording and scanning service here in London. And he had a 65mm recorder capable of recording out 15 perf IMAX. So we did some test work with Simon's setup as well. In terms of the scope work, actually, it was all done at 4K.
What bit depth were you doing that, though? So was that just 10-bit log as a 2K DPX Cineon would be, or were you going higher bit depth?
Well, it's 10-bit log still.
Right.
We work internally using the OpenEXR format, right. So that's the 32-bit floating point linear. And then when we send stuff out through our studio, it's converted to DPX, has all the various lookup tables applied to it, and goes into log space.
Okay, so sorry, I interrupted. You were about to say about the scope output.
Yeah, the scope stuff was actually all done at 4K, and apart from the shots, the scope shots that started as IMAX shots. So all the IMAX shots were delivered both in IMAX format and in scope format. And the scope format versions were, as I say, a 240 extraction from the IMAX plate, but we maintained the full 5.6K horizontal resolution in the scope material, and so that was then shot out to scope at the higher resolution. So there should be a noticeable quality difference even in the scope version of the film when you see that in the cinemas.
Well, I'd totally recommend at this point, Paul, that if you do get a chance, you should go and see it. Cause
don't worry, I shall be there at the IMAX. I have my ticket booked.
It is very much like a low-grain, pristine, very, very highly, you know, highly detailed shot.
Interesting. You mentioned the grain there. The biggest challenges we had in terms of getting stuff to work at IMAX is we have a handful of shots which were shot VistaVision because the IMAX units were supplemented by a couple of VistaVision cameras to get additional angles when they just didn't have enough IMAX cameras to cover the action. And then the miniatures were all shot VistaVision as well. And the Vista stuff was scanned at 6K, and we worked on it at 6K, but the grain size was noticeably different with the IMAX. So we did a lot of work to degrain the images and then reapply IMAX grain to them and digitally sharpen them so there wouldn't be too much of a jump between the VistaVision and the IMAX stuff. But it was quite tricky.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the data management side of this in terms of color spaces, I mean, we've already discussed obviously pulling from multiple different visual effects formats and live action and models, etc. But then you're pulling these different film stocks, different cameras, different lenses, and then trying to integrate those into a cohesive unit. How long did you have on the production? Was this, were you given a lot of time to this? Was this kind of been a rush job?
Well, we started, I personally was working on the show, I think, pretty much a year from start to finish. The beginning of Dark Knight overlapped with the end of Order of the Phoenix. So I was actually still delivering finals on Phoenix when I had to fly out and do a little location still shoot in Chicago and then come back and finish off Phoenix and then charge through the rest of Dark Knight. As it happens, the same thing's kind of Harry Potter's had its revenge, and I've had to overlap Half-Blood Prince with the end of the Dark Knight. So that's been kind of non-stop the last few years for me.
You must be really looking forward to some kind of romantic comedy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like all the kind of doom and gloom and the magic stuff. That's all kind of cool stuff to do, actually. But we did have enough time to actually get set up, and of course we were able to reuse a lot of the pipeline we built for Batman Begins in terms of color space. The key thing that this film has in common with Batman Begins, quite apart from the production crew involved, is that there's no digital intermediate on this movie. Chris and Wally are still very, very keen to keep this in as a traditional lab process. So we don't get grading numbers from a DI suite. So all the grading we do is done to match clips. We spend a lot of time calibrating and making sure that we're matching the color profiles of the stock and the way that they're printing it. So we shot a lot of digital versus film tests to make sure that our color cubes and our lookups were set up correctly. We were able to reuse some of the stuff we'd set up for Batman Begins, so that helped us out there, and that helped consolidate everything together. And it's also it's fair to say that the client is a kind of known quantity. You know, we've been there before. We know what Chris and Wally are looking for. They obviously wanted to push it. They wanted to go a lot further than they did last time. But there is a thematic continuity in the way that they're putting things together, as well as a technical one.
Well, as I said at the outset, I don't think it's being grandiose to say that this is one of those rare films that the sequel has outdone the original. And certainly that there are very few films that that do that. But when they do break through like this, it's remarkable. And I honestly think this is one of the best films we've seen in a long time. It's so many levels, and it's actually quite long. It's like about, 2.5 hours?
I think it's 2 hours, 32 minutes. It's longer than Batman Begins, which is quite a long film.
Yeah, yet it doesn't feel like it. And, of course, tremendous credit to the script writers, because the actual story maintains it and it's not predictable. You don't know where it's going, and at the end I'm not going to give away the ending for those that haven't seen it, but it's certainly not one of those traditional comic books where you just have the big battle between the goodie and the baddie, and the baddie's going to look like he's going to win right up until the last second, and he doesn't. It isn't that kind of a film. It's intelligent and it's incredibly well done. So I just full marks. I mean, I really can't say enough about how great this film is, and certainly the IMAX experience was just awesome. I mean, I'm not that easily impressed. It was just.
I think this one of the things. Another reason for going to see this in IMAX is I do think there's a strong chance this may be one of the few times that we see a film done this way for IMAX, because obviously there's a move afoot to convert IMAX cinemas to digital projection, and as far as I know, the digital projection in the IMAX theaters, won't actually match the resolution that is inherently there in camera original IMAX negative.
Well, I mean, I can quote you some numbers for our local experience here, which is if you were to convert it into pixels, a normal sort of film is going to be about 7 million. This film was projected when it goes to IMAX at the equivalent of about 100 million pixels, and it's about 13 for the digital projection IMAX version. So it's a smaller, it's better than obviously 35, but it's certainly not in the same zone as the full. So you're right. I mean, this is, if somebody cares about visual effects or just cares about good films, this is a once in a, I don't know how long, I won't say once in a lifetime, but it's certainly right up there as like, you must see this at IMAX if you love the art, because it's so good. And it's also not only just that, but it's engagingly good as a film. And if you can rip yourself away from it to look at it technically, the mind just boggles at some of the things that guys must put up with. As I said, the single sort of idea of a single load being only 100 seconds before you run out of film at 24 frames a second, and putting this thing on wires and flying it. And there are shots, I must admit, the first time the first shot came up, the audience clapped, and all it was an establishing shot of a city, and it just looked so good.
I know which shot you're talking about. We early on in the post process, I arranged for a special screening of the IMAX prologue, which we'd done some work on at the BFI IMAX Theatre here in London. Now, we took the entire DNEG crew down, the Framestore crew came along, and it was interesting that everyone was being kind of blasé about it, because they thought, oh, well, we've already seen IMAX films. We did The Order of the Phoenix was converted to IMAX last year. People have seen films like Spider-Man bumped up to IMAX through the DMR process. And the prologue starts off that way with the all the legendary pictures and Warner Brothers logos come up, and they're just straight 35mm bumped up via DMR to IMAX. And then the screen goes black, and you cut into that opening shot, the push in across the cityscape into the window that then explodes out as the bank heist begins. And it was extraordinary to see 250 visual effects artists all do a sharp intake of breath.
It is that different. It's that remarkable. And you're right, that first 6 minutes of that bank heist, and that extraordinary filmic short depth of field on a screen the size of a football field. And of course, you know, the other good thing is, let's face it, many cinema plexes don't have good projection. There's like some spotty 14-year-old kid running it, and you're lucky if it's even at the lamp up at full notch. Though the IMAX has the most magnificent sound system. It's properly calibrated. Yes. So, you know, you're right, even 35 up-res with their clever technique. And I do, you know, say that the work that the guys do at DKP is really, really good in that respect. But when it cuts to the full IMAX shot, oh my God, there was just an audible gasp from the audience, and then our crowd started applauding. And then when there's a shot where Batman, I won't give away any plot here, jumps off a building and goes forward, and the whole audience literally like moves in its seat for a shot that shouldn't be that dramatic. I mean, it's a good shot, but it's not like a shot that, you know, it's not like a surprise shot. He just, you know, sensibly jumps off a building as Batman does. And the entire audience, again, just gasps. So that was the stuff that wasn't even meant to be. Both of those shots I just described weren't meant to be spectacular shots. They're just meant to be good shots, let alone trucks flipping and stuff. And the work you did in that chase sequence, oh, my God.
It was great. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that's in there as well. You know, when you see the ferry boats, they're all digital, as is all the water that they're on, the big cityscapes in the background, the CG cityscapes. There's a lot of detail and kind of little bits here and there that you see in the film, which will hopefully pass unnoticed, because that's the whole point of it. Is, you know, we are doing our best to be seamless and not draw attention to things there. And there's a couple of shots, particularly towards the end of the big sequence inside the Pruitt building, where Batman assaults the Joker's lair, that features some complete CG replacements for what had originally intended to be live action shots. That I think will just blow past and no one will ever notice them. With full digital stunt doubles and things in full frame.
So which sequence is that?
There's a moment in the inside the Pruitt building sequence where Batman is trying to prevent the SWAT guys from taking out all of the hostages.
Yep.
And he grabs two of the guys dressed in clown masks and dives over a ledge, down a stairwell, as the SWAT guys in the background.
Yep.
And that shot where you see Batman run at the two clowns is entirely CG. It was originally done as a practical stunt, but the stunt was just too dangerous to actually stage it properly. You could never get that moment where Batman wrapped his arms around the guys and dragged them over the edge. Also, they had a lot of pyros going off in the shot, which made it difficult to read the action. And it was about 5 weeks before delivery, Chris turned around and said, "Can you take out the pyros from this shot?" And we said, "Well, no, not really." And he said, "Well, can you replace the shot?" And so we scratched our heads and thought about it. We decided to give it a go. We completed that, I think, about 2 or 3 days before the final delivery of the thing. But it's a tremendous piece of work that the stunt double animator Nicky Brody put in, the guys who built the environment, Dan Neal and Perry McCafferty, and then Robin Beard, who composited it. They just really nailed it, and it just sits in there seamlessly. It was very, very pleasing. That kind of work being done on the fly was a real testament to the robust nature of the pipeline that everybody had put together.
Well, at the risk of sounding sycophantic, I mean, I don't think I've ever said this, but I said it at the beginning of this interview, but this is a masterpiece. I just think it's magnificent. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk about it. I hope everybody enjoys the film as much as you have.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Mike.
Well, again, I just got to say, I said it before at the beginning, if you have a chance, check this film out in IMAX. And I think it'll be interesting for you as well, because they talked about the idea of having the two different ratios on the screen in the IMAX. And I was kind of concerned, you know, like Mike was, and how it actually would work. But it really is pretty transparent. And, I don't think anyone really noticed. If you're looking for it as part of the industry and so forth, I'm sure you'll notice it. But it certainly wasn't distracting what I thought it might be in that result. So anyway, fun podcast. And thanks to Paul Franklin for taking the time to speak with us. Well, it's also our second week now in the July term over at FX PhD. If you haven't checked out our new courses, head over to fxphd.com. Check out the O Week video that covers all the courses we've got going. We've got fantastic Red and DLP ones. We've got a great After Effects course with Mark Christensen and Mark Colleran covering compositing as well as UI design stuff. Again, check it out at fxphd.com. If you have any comments or questions, drop us a line at podcast@fxguide.com. If you'd like to even be a guest on the show, we'd love to hear from you. But until next time, I'm John Montgomery. For my FX Guide co-founders, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.